Haunted Night, live with Tamara Thorne and Alistair Cross.
Like to thank W.J. Pierce for creating and performing our music. Good evening and welcome to Thorn and Cross, Haunted Nights Live. We're your hosts, Alistair Cross and Tamara Thorne. Thank you for joining us. Tonight, we'd like to tell you a little about the entry in the Ravencrest saga. It has everything you need for Halloween. Ghosts, demons, priests, it's all here. Here's Tamara to tell you more.
Yes, our latest publication is Ravencrest Saga Exorcism. In a remote part of California, Ravencrest Manor, imported stone by stone from England more than two centuries ago, looms tall and terrifying. And don't mind that noise at the cat throwing up in the background. It looms tall and terrifying, gathering its dark. And all the way from the top of the entertainment center to the floor. Let's try this again. Imported stone by stone from England more than two centuries ago, looms tall and terrifying, gathering its dark and unnatural powers and drawing those it wants as its own. In Exorcism, Book 3 of the Ravencrest Saga, something evil is stirring in the deep, dark waters of the estate's indoor pool as ghostly jazz-age parties fill the air with phantom music. Within the mansion, a maid is visited regularly by a demon lover. And governess Belinda Moreland is haunted by the tormented spirit of Violet LeBlanc, a silent movie star who was driven mad in her prime and wants Belinda to help her in her secret search for justice. The Ravencrest Saga series is first released in serialized installments, and they're all available for Exorcism as a full novel right now. Our next one, Shadowland, is currently being released in installments, and we will be releasing another one next week. All right,
yes,
Alistair.
Yes, we will. We are kicking butt on Ravencrest, and if you need to brush up on the specter scandals and sinister goings-on at Ravencrest, you can get the first two complete novels, the first three complete novels, The Ghost of Ravencrest, The Witches of Ravencrest, and, of course, The Ravencrest Saga Exorcism in paperback or ebook at Amazon.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, you can learn more about what we do at our websites, alistaircross.com and tamathorn.com. You can visit our mutual blog at thornandcross.wordpress.com. If you tweet, our handles are at crossalistair and at tamathorn. You can visit our Haunted Nights Live page on Facebook, or you can find us on Instagram at thornandcross or at official_alistaircross. For more information on the show, you can visit Authors on the Air on Facebook, Twitter, and at authorsontheair.com. Thorn and Cross Haunted Nights Live is a broadcast of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. All right, now on to the better stuff, the fun stuff, the good stuff. We have got good stuff because we have a great guest, you guys. Tonight, we are talking to Robert Masello. He is an award-winning journalist, television writer, and the best-selling author of many books. His produced television credits have aired on networks ranging from CBS to Showtime, Fox to Sci-Fi, and include such popular shows as Charmed, Sliders, Poltergeist the Legacy, and Early Edition. His latest novel, The Haunting of H.G. Wells, is available now, and so we're going to be talking about that, among other things. Welcome to the show, Robert. Mm-hmm. How are you?
Welcome.
I am fine. Thank you very much for having me on.
We love having you.
You are welcome.
We love your books, too.
I have built my whole week around this. My month. There's nothing to do these days, you know?
It's not going to be that exciting.
Well, it could be. Maybe it really is now that no one can do anything else. Well, thank you.
All right. Yes, we are fans of your work. We are fans of you personally and of your work. And this latest, The Haunting of H.G. Wells, first of all, let's start at the very, very, very beginning. I love the cover. I always have to tell people when I love their covers. So I got to tell you, I love the cover. I'd pick it up based on that
itself. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, actually, and I must say the publisher in this case and you guys as often published authors yourselves know that, you know, getting that cover right is always a challenge. And in this case, a lot of different covers, and they actually, believe it or not, they actually listened to me when I kept saying, I think we want that. And so, once, I'm actually happy with my title and my cover.
It's
nice.
Gorgeous.
Nice.
Yeah.
So now, what can you tell us, without giving too much away, what can you tell us about the book itself? What is it about?
Well, it's about H.G. Wells during the First World War. It's set in 1914 and 1915, chiefly. The inspiration came from a story called The Bowman, which was published by and written by Arthur Machen. And he was a mystic and a Welsh writer in his own day. And he wrote a story because the English were being routed by the German forces in Belgium and in France. And it was so dispiriting that he wrote this story that was meant to be published in a newspaper as fiction. But in point of fact, it wound up being published in the news hole instead of as fiction. And so the British public reacted to it, because in the story, the British soldiers are rescued by a brigade of angels led by St. George. And this convinced the English public that read it as news that heaven was on their side and that angels would intervene. And even though Arthur Machen later kept saying, no, it was a short story, it's fiction, I made it up to bolster everybody's... Nobody wanted to hear that. So in the English, every pulpit in England was broadcasting this to advocate and to prove that the angels in heaven were on the side of the British forces. What they ended up doing is, Winston Churchill wanted to back it, other people did. And in the book, in my book, H.G. Wells is sent to the Western Front to confirm it and to also get other stories and to write reports from the front about the British troops in order to lift their morale and to lift the morale of the citizenry back in England. So that was kind of the inspiration for the book.
Very cool.
Nice.
Wow.
Very
Wells
cool.
has a
yeah.
habit of writing things that people believe, and maybe thanks to Orson Welles too, but, you know, that's very cool. I love his work anyway, and I had no idea they'd believe the Band of Angels.
yeah,
I know,
and
right?
That's
interesting.
Yeah,
and in my book, when Wells goes to the Western Front, he doesn't actually see angels, but he encounters some other very strange denizens of the battlefront. And again, this is based on real history, which was, you know, of course we know about the trench warfare in the First World War and the. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, you know, I mean, I'm not kidding. I mean, 60,000 men could die in a single day just simply fighting over a few hundred yards of mud. It was insane. And a lot of them deserted. They wanted to desert, but unlike in any other war, you couldn't do it very effectively. If you were fighting in the Battle of Agincourt, if you were fighting in the Battle of Waterloo, You know what? You could walk over a hill and lie down under a tree and relax for a little while, or even try to run away. But in the First World War, you could not do that, because the lines extended from, you know, Switzerland all the way through Belgium and France. If you tried to run away, you would be caught as a deserter and shot. And if you were told to go over the top, over the trenches into the no man's land, you'd be shot by the enemy. There was absolutely It was an absolutely terrifying hellscape for 4 years there.
Wow.
You have a lot of
war.
Your books. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And a lot of your books are you know, really rich with history, and this one is no exception. How do you go about your – because, see, I think for some people, research, especially into history and stuff like that, just kind of comes – you know, really naturally, it's just something that you really love. And I get the feeling, I could be wrong, I get the feeling that that's true about you. I think that for other people, you really have to set time aside and really work at it.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do your research? What's your process?
Well, I am one of the people who always did read history, and I always loved it, even though sometimes I mess around with it a bit for my novels. But not much, actually. I always say that about 90% of the history that you read in my books is accurate. But I always tell kids, don't write your term paper based on what you read in one of my books, because it could be the 5 or extent where I had to compress things like a chronology or move mm-hmm. something a little bit to one side. But by and large, I stick to the historical record. And the great thing about it is the history is always more interesting and more bizarre than anything I could have made up.
Right.
When I wrote books in the, you know, back in the 80s and the 90s, which is giving away my age, but I was only in grade school then, you understand. It was hard. I would have to go to the New York Public Library, and you'd have to check out books and request books and Xerox pages, and it was very time-consuming. But, of course, as you guys know, I mean, now it's just astonishing. I can write so much more easily because if I need to check anything, you know, mm-hmm. Google has made it possible at 3 o'clock in the morning to check out
right.
what cavalry officer would carry. What would it look like? What would it weigh? And you can tap into this vast network of other people who are experts and aficionados about anything from, you know, the First World War to Jane Austen and communicate with them in the middle of the night.
It's wonderful.
Right.
It is wonderful and it's remarkable. And I do have friends who have written, you know, other history books or tried to, or history-based, I should say. And the problem is you have to at some point know when to draw the line and stop because you can get lost in research and never emerge again. I know people like that.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It's always a temptation. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, when I'm doing a book
like... We
call
each other out frequently.
mm-hmm.
Yeah, you have to because... It's a never-ending process. You could always find another source to check and another interesting thing which sends you off on another tangent or in another direction. I find that, you know, usually if I'm doing a book like this one about H.G. Wells, I pick out a couple of the most authoritative-sounding biographies. I read those, and this book is largely about his relationship with the English journalist and suffragette Rebecca West. And I'll read a couple of books about her, a couple of books about H.G. Wells, certainly a couple of books about the First World War. Then I kind of have to start writing. I mean, I've spent a few months doing that. And then you have to go, you know what? I'll never know all of it. I just got to get most of it right.
Yeah.
So
was surprised to find out Rebecca West was real.
We're
talking over each other. No, that's okay. I was surprised Rebecca West was real. I did not know that.
Yeah, Rebecca West is one of my heroines, not only in the book but in life. She was an amazing writer. She started out when she was like 19, 20 years old. She was instrumental in the suffragette movement in England. She was one of the first writers for magazines like Free Woman magazine, which is in the book and is real. She wrote about communist dictatorships. She wrote about the history of Western Europe, about political upheavals for many years. She didn't, she was interviewed by William F. Buckley. She lived to a ripe old age.
Wow.
And she did indeed have this passionate affair with H.G. Wells when she was 19, 20, and he was 49 years old. And they actually had a son, Anthony West, who went on to prominence. So all of that stuff in the book is actually factual and historical. And they did indeed... call each other respectively Panther and Jaguar.
nice.
This is Jaguar, and their letters, which are extant, are unbelievable. I mean, they had a very torrid affair, and H.G. Wells was also famous at the time, not only for his sci-fi novels like The Time Machine and The War of the Worlds and The Invisible Man, but also he was a passionate advocate of free love and of women's rights and of the women's right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
He was in his day the most famous English writer, and as such we have to remember that it's kind of like being the equivalent of a rock star today.
Wow.
H.G. Wells was a major celebrity, and wherever he went, let's face it, young women were throwing themselves at him. He got into a lot of predicaments that way.
The free love part. I'm really enjoying Jane, his wife. So she was fine with that, right? That's
Was. She was cognizant of his passades. I mean, as I tried to indicate in the book, I think, you know, she's human. I'm not sure that she was altogether crazy about the notion. He had divorced his first wife because of an affair with her. And she understood, or at least came to understand, that this is something he was going to do. In fact, she kind of vetted his affairs. I mean, he was having a couple with women of, you know, who were older and more substantial and settled, and those were easier for her to deal with. I think she always was, and I hope I indicated this to some extent in the book, you know, she was threatened a little bit, of course, by Rebecca West, because Rebecca West was so young, so talented, and so beautiful, that, you know, she always had to worry, was he going to become so passionately involved that he would leave her? But his relationship with Jane was kind of different. It really was, they were solid, and they were just devoted partners, and he relied upon her for so much, everything from, you know, proofreading his scripts and helping him with his ideas, but to providing a solid home life for him to return to, which he did need.
Yeah, sounds like it. He's a very interesting man. Boy, what a lot of energy to do all that.
Oh, I know, right? He's a busy guy.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, I can't remember offhand, but there are dozens and dozens of novels that you've never even heard of that he wrote that were simply about the social mores of the time, and that were about, you know, the political scene in England, or about the home front during the war. They were not the sci-fi novels that made him famous, you know, before the turn of the century. They were books he wrote, you know, in the 1920s, the 1930s. He went on and on until he died in 1946.
Wow, that's amazing. So
yeah, he's almost as prolific as you two.
Almost.
Oh, but he lives on, and we go around scratching and giggling. So yeah.
Yes.
So live on.
So what would you? There's I'm always curious to know, because there are always good, as the writer, there are always really smooth parts that are just, you know, you fly right through it and it's fun and it's easy. And then there are the parts that you kind of hit the brick wall and for whatever reason, have a really hard time with. What were some good and hard, difficult areas in this book for you as the writer?
Gee, that's a good question. I mean, the good and interesting parts for me were things that I was interested in writing about from the get-go. And that included the Arthur Machen story and what happened in England, and also describing the trench warfare and the fact that some of the soldiers from both sides actually deserted and united, as is in the book, under no man's land in the secret tunnels that had been built. That was something that I was interested in. I'd read about years ago, and I wanted to write. It was when I got back to London and had to do the plot having to do with sabotage and German saboteurs, and all of that, also, by the way, is also based on his that I was finding it, you know, harder, just because I want to get everything right, and you know that you're going to hear from readers. I'm not going to hear from readers about necessarily what went on in the trenches in Belgium, because nobody was around for that that's still alive anymore. But I am going to hear if I get anything wrong, like a street in London that goes the wrong way, or putting the cathedral on the wrong side of the street, and making sure that London felt real, because I've been to London, but, you know, not for many, many years, and I've only been there for short times when I was there as a tourist. You know, I had hoped to go over again and spend some serious time there before writing this book, but I didn't have a chance. So those were the hard parts, and also, Tamara, I know that you will agree with me on this. I mean, I am an animal lover, a lot of this book revolves around atrocities that were committed against animals and livestock in World War. And researching that and finding that was horrifying to me, and very hard to write about. But it's a chapter of that war that was important, because those armies on both sides relied upon pack animals, mules, donkeys, horses. So that was a spot to attack the enemy on by depriving them of their livestock.
So we're talking about livestock, not say
hard to write.
You're not. I don't read anything that has cat horror in it. Is there any cat problem in there?
No, the cats are spared in this. And even having
okay,
to do
good.
with the livestock, I did it just enough so that you knew what was going on. But both sides were involved in it, but the Germans were very far in advance of this and had been developing ways to destroy the Allied forces by going at them in this way.
Wow. That's horrible.
Seriously.
Speaking of cats, though, I love the scene where Wells goes to Arthur Machen's apartment. The descriptions were just hysterical and gross, and I loved them. And
it
made me want to read about him. And
he was
Crowley
a very
showing up. Yeah,
lived a long life, and he wrote a lot of occult stories
The
and
Great
fiction.
God Pan. Yeah.
Yes, the Great
I
God
think our
Pan.
Our listeners would recognize that. Yes.
Yes, and he was very popular in his day, but he's kind of been forgotten for the most part, except by people mm-hmm. like you guys and me and probably people listening to this show.
Yeah, we all know who he is. And he was a cat lover. I loved his cats and the Holmes, or Holmes, not Holmes, he's not real. Wells was a cat fancier as well. I say, Holmes, what kind of
And of course we've got Alistair.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was fun. I
Crowley
really
would
enjoyed
have,
that.
You know,
yeah.
to your listeners and audience. Mm-hmm. And I actually had to, it was shocking to my editor some of the stuff about Aleister Crowley. And I said, listen, I soft-pedaled a lot of that. I mean.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. I used him a bit in my most recent solo. Mostly my guy wanted to be just like him. But Crowley's an interesting character. That was whoa when I saw him showing up there. Don't touch his cat.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
This book
that
is
stuff
so well
about
put
his,
together.
Mm-hmm. And about his being the Earl of Boleskin. That's all true. I mean, he did have, costume trunks of wardrobes that he would wear for his black magic rituals, which I got to say, in most cases involved... involved him practicing some kind of sex magic on one of his willing disciples. I don't think how many of the rituals involved somebody getting naked for him and him doing unspeakable things.
Oh, I could make so many political jokes right now, but I won't make any. I love this. And Wells, since I was a kid, I've loved him. And it's so much fun to read about him in depth. And your research is just impeccable. It always is. I've known you for, we've known each other since we were sort of young.
We're still young at heart.
That's right.
Really immature.
Yes, immature. I'm still immature. I don't know about you, but So H.G. Wells, I had no idea he wrote that, what was it called, Marriages?
Yeah,
that surprised me. Because I hadn't ever thought beyond the science fiction and the historical. I think I have one of his history nonfiction books here. But
he wrote
really
a lot of
that.
Novels that were pretty much, social commentary about, political and social issues of the day. He was a member of the Fabian Society until he got thrown out. and he came from... And I think this is maybe alluded to in the book. I don't know how much, but he came from an impoverished background. His father ran kind of a sporting goods and notions shop that never made a profit in a small town. Uh-huh. And his mother was in service at a big house, which is where Wells had access to the library of the big house. It was called Upark, UPPARK.
Right.
And interestingly enough, and again, I think I put this in the book, but Upark, the estate where his mother worked and where Wells spent a lot of time as a boy, did have a lot of subterranean tunnels where everything from the wine cellar to, passageways for the servants were employed.
Wow.
And that shows up in books like, the Time Machine, where the Morlocks live.
Oh, yeah.
And he wrote a famous essay called Boots about the shop where all it was kind of like a basement apartment almost, where you could look up through the little window and all you could see was the boots and the shoes of the people on the high street walking by.
That sounds very familiar.
Yeah, so he complained about it all throughout his life that he was a little bit sickly and spare when he was young because he didn't get wholesome food. I mean, it was pretty impoverished.
That was interesting.
Yeah,
you have that in the book.
Now, we are just about out of time, but there is one other thing. It's a little bit off subject, but we were talking about it before the show. And I'm curious about it because it's such a different world now, what with the COVID and all. We were talking before the show a little bit about what, you know, television and, you know, networks and even publishers are you know, looking for right now.
Yeah.
You're kind of in the know. So can we talk really briefly about that? What's hot?
And
right
if you
now?
Have anything coming up. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yes. I've been thinking about it because I've been talking to my agent and my manager actually just sent me an email about it. And, you know, what they're really looking for is diverse voices, as they call it. They're looking for voices and stories that have to do with social issues today, whether it's Black Lives Matter or the Me Too movement. And I don't know if you followed it, but there was a huge bidding war right now on a book, which I haven't read, called Leave the World Behind. Everybody from Julia Roberts to Denzel Washington was pursuing it. It's a novel in which an upscale white couple go to a country house that's kind of remote and suddenly all the power goes out. And an older black couple appears claiming that they're the owners of the house and that they had to leave the city because all the power went out and they had to leave Manhattan because they couldn't get the elevator up to their apartment. It's a kind of apocalyptic story, I guess. I don't know much more about it because I haven't read about it, but I was just reading about the bidding war that's going on that went on for it, and I think Netflix won. But if you are a writer from a diverse background, Hollywood and the publishing houses also are really looking for your stories. I've also been told, and there was an article in the LA Times about this a few days ago, about how Hollywood, the studios, and all, of course, the streaming services are buying a lot of books now. Because I guess the executives have had time to sit home and read for a change.
Right.
Or contemporary kind of thrillers. And, you know, for me, that would mean changing course a bit because I used to write books like that. And the last, you know, I don't know, 10 or 12 books I've written have all been period pieces in history, which is not as popular right now, though there are exceptions. Netflix did a movie called Enola Holmes about Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't watched it, but I do want to see. So period history is not dead, but if you have a great contemporary idea that isn't so on point, I probably wouldn't write something about this particular pandemic because, again, we hope it's behind us by the time anything you write now would actually be published or produced.
Yeah.
I hope so. But fingers crossed.
All right. What can you tell us about what you're working on now? What's coming up from you?
You know, I'm never quite sure. I mean, I have an idea for a book. Again, it's history, but it's about some famous figures from the 1930s, one of whom has been long forgotten. What I usually look for is some kind of historical confluence or coincidence that other people might not have noticed. And these two figures, who shall go nameless for the time being, might have met under very peculiar circumstances. And I thought, well, what would have happened if they'd met? So I've been kind of, you know, noodling around with that. I've written a few chapters. But, you know, it's tough. Once you decide that you're going to write one of these history-based books, as I do, you have to really be in love with your characters and your subject because you are going to be living with them for the next 2 years.
Right.
You know, a year of writing the book and then a year to the editing and get it out, you know, so.
Right.
Exactly.
big commitment.
Well, whatever you write next, we hope that you will come back and discuss it with us because we love having you. And
we do.
Yeah, thank you. I'm looking forward to more from you. I've been a fan for years, and I mean that. That's true. I started with Blood and Ice. Yeah, Blood and Ice is the first one I read. So it's not, you know, just a few years back, but made me a lifelong fan.
Well, thank you very much. I'm a fan of your work, and of course, I have known Tamara forever. Ever since moving to Los Angeles. I think you were truly one of the first people I met here.
At Dark Delicacies, probably. Yeah.
It was either at Dark Delicacies or there was also a
Dangerous Visions.
Could have been Dangerous Visions. There was also a bookstore in Westwood in those days that. Stuff, and I'm not sure I didn't meet you there.
That could have been it too.
Yeah.
Wow. We're old.
In the days when there were so many independent bookstores that we could actually, you know, go from one to the next to the next.
It was. Wow. Boy. Well,
we look forward to having you back on. And before we do let you go, I do want to say congratulations because everywhere I look, The Haunting of H.G. Wells is selling really, really well. It's at number one all over the place, and I think that's well-deserved. So congratulations on that.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you very much. It has done very well. It's selling briskly in the U.K., where, of course, H.G. Wells is even better known. And we have been selling foreign rights right, left, and center. So it's doing real well.
Nice.
That's wonderful.
All right. Well, thank you again for being on. And we'll be in touch, of course.
And thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Yeah. And to the listeners, thank you for listening. And until next week, we wish you haunted nights.
And sweet screams.
Thank you for listening.
Haunted Nights, live with Tamara Thorne and Alistair Cross.